And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Command the children of Israel that they bring unto thee pure oil olive beaten for the light, to cause the lamps to burn continually in the tabernacle of the congregation. And it shall be a statute forever in your generation.
The Eternal Light. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Eternal Light, a program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today's program, celebrating the centennial of Woodrow Wilson's birth, Nor Reach the Uplands, is by Marion Voigt. It is written in the Talmud, Rabbi Tarfon said, It is not incumbent on you to finish the work, but neither are you free to desist from it. The practical man hears this, and what does he say?
Well, sure, I grant you can't always finish a job, but if you don't see at least a chance of it, why bother starting?
It is written also in the works of the rabbis, Scholars and wise men magnify the peace of the world. And the practical man responds...
Oh, sure. Sure, in a way, it's true enough. But scholars, they're apt to be pretty dreamy fellows. Off on some cloud most of the time. Wait for them to do something, and you'd wait a long time.
The practical man lives in the real world. He reads the papers and knows the score. He read the papers, for instance, back in 1908, and knew the score then.
Well, I see by the paper that fellow Wilson's come up against some of the facts of life, no? This'll bring him down to earth in a hurry.
That fellow Wilson was the scholarly president of Princeton University, a university which had managed, oddly enough, to make the news all across the country because of certain democratic reforms its president wanted to make.
Not such bad ideas at that. But now along comes this fellow Proctor, willing to give the school $500,000 if they'll do just the opposite of what Wilson wants. Well, a fellow like Wilson can't fight $500,000. Nobody can.
A practical man lives in the real world. He knows what's what. But sometimes he gets a surprise.
I am sorry, gentlemen, members of the board. I believe very strongly in those principles I've been advocating. So strongly, in fact, that I cannot see remaining connected with this university when those ideas are abandoned. Therefore, as you accept this bequest of $500,000. Will you also please accept my resignation as president?
The trustees, astounded by anyone thinking so lightly of $500,000, took another look at the sum themselves and decided they were more impressed with the man. And Wilson stayed on as president of Princeton. For a while, that is. And then...
What shall I say, Ellen? You know what it will mean if I say yes. An end for a long while of our happy, easy family life. There will be weeks of campaigning and speech-making. It will be hard on you and the girls as well as on me. Is it worth it?
But how can you even ask, my dear? It's what you've always wanted. It's what all your years of study and writing have been aimed towards. A statesman's career.
This is politics, Ellen. And pretty rough-and-tumble politics at that.
It's the only way to start towards what you want.
After all the effort, all the sacrifices, I still might not make it.
Have you ever hesitated before a fight because there was a chance of losing? Do what you know is right. Say yes.
And so Woodrow Wilson agreed to be the Democratic nominee for governor of the state of New Jersey. And the practical man shook his head again.
Well, that does it. Look who steamrolled that nomination through the convention. Big fellow Jim Smith and all the other party bosses of the state. And that poor starry-eyed idealist thinks he'll have some say about things if he does make it to Trenton.
A good many members of the reform element in the Democratic Party felt the same as the practical man, but Wilson's campaigning breathed such sincerity that their doubts crumbled.
I'll be darned. He made it. And with the biggest plurality a Democratic candidate ever got in New Jersey. Well, he sounded good, all right. But now let him try to do something about it with the bosses moving in for the payoff.
Woodrow, what is this? I thought before you even accepted Jim Smith's support, he promised you he'd give up his ambitions to be senator.
He did. Very promptly and cheerfully. But now we've made it, he doesn't see any reason to let a silly promise keep him out of the nation's most exclusive club.
Big fellow Jim Smith as a United States senator. It's horrible. Why, he has no more idea of lawmaking or... Unthinkable. Does he think you won't be able to do a thing now?
It's his idea that I'm already looking forward to something bigger than governor in New Jersey. If I try to cross him now, he will make sure I never go any further than where I am right now.
Could he stop you from going further?
It's quite possible. But there is no point in going any further if every move I make must be subject to his approval. So look, Ellen. Here is the statement I am releasing today. I don't think the big fellow will be going to Washington during my 4 years as governor, at least.
But now, with the big fella through, the big fella's nephew, himself the boss of Newark, came charging into the fight. The argument grew heated in the governor's office.
Accusations of using patronage come poorly from you, Mr. Nugent. I think this discussion might well end right now. There is the door, sir.
There is the door? You take that tone with me? Along with everything else, Watson, you are no gentleman.
And you, Mr. Nugent, are no judge. Good day.
Oh, and you are no judge. Oh, by George, that fellow Wilson's not such a dreamer at that. He can give it with the best of them. Yeah, maybe he will make out with some of those big ideas after all.
1911. A simpler, less self-conscious America just settling down to explore the results of terrific expansion and industrial conquest found Wilson's program for New Jersey the most advanced kind of liberalism. Nominations by direct primary. A corrupt practice act for the state. Regulation of public utilities. An employee's liability act. Measures we take for granted today because that fellow Wilson, a scholar of government and a student of history, stepped forth from his study and entered the real world of politics.
Why, George, you've got to hand it to him. And you know, these speeches of his make darn good reading. Oh, but all this talk about making him the Democratic nominee for president. Oh, Tommy Rock. Your average voter doesn't care that much about issues. He just wants to be stirred up.
Still, it was a curious thing how many average voters were reacting to Wilson's speeches. And these days, something more than a boyhood love of oratory, more helpful than years of classroom lecturing, was quickening Wilson's voice.
My dear, you're pale with fatigue. You'll get another of your headaches if you don't put away that speech now and come to bed.
Yes, I know, Ellen. It's late. Ellen, I have changed in the last few years, did you know?
Changed?
Not towards you, my dear. Don't look so startled. Never that. I'm talking about my beliefs in the principles of government. You know, I used to be a good deal of a Hamiltonian. But for all Hamilton's genius, he never learned to trust the people. To him, the mass of humankind was always a great beast. A beast that couldn't reason, couldn't argue, couldn't think.
Somehow I don't think you ever really believed that.
I ever did. It's all gone now, Ellen. Now I'm convinced that the whole hope of mankind lies with mankind itself. Just let the people's leader speak to them clearly, honestly, showing them where the greater freedom lies. And they'll choose the path of freedom and justice, instinctively.
It's a wonderful faith, Woodrow, but a hard one. Look how it's driving you.
It's the only faith that's worthy of America, Ellen. You go along to bed now. I'll be along soon.
The talk, the work, booming Wilson for president, went on. Colonel Harvey, editor of the powerful Harper's Weekly, was one of the boom's chief supporters. And the practical man nodded skeptically.
Well, there you've got it. Wilson talks big about hating money power, being against franchises, and who's pulling the strings for him? Colonel Harvey, right-hand man of the biggest franchise grabber of all, Thomas Fortune Ryan. Why, his whole magazine is nothing but a mouthpiece for J.P. Morgan.
One more thing, Wilson. I understand there's been some talk about my connections with Wall Street. Now, you don't have any feeling that my support will be an embarrassment to you, do you?
You want the truth, Colonel Harvey?
Why, of course.
Then I have to tell you frankly, much as I appreciate all you have done for me, your support does embarrass me.
Well, I'll be. Oh, Wilson's really cooked his goose this time. There's the end of his hopes of the nomination.
And once again, the practical man was wrong, and Wilson's faith in the people at large was justified. July, and the word went out from the Democratic Convention in Baltimore to the cottage on the Jersey coast, where Wilson and his wife were waiting.
Yes? Wilson speaking. So? On the 46th ballot. I see. Yes. Thank you very much.
Woodrow?
Well, dear, we won't be going on that holiday to England after all.
You made it. They nominated you. Oh, my dear.
You are happy, Ellen?
I'm happy. I'm sad. I'm frightened. I am glad, so glad you're going to have a chance at last to do some of the things you've dreamed of.
Ellen, I'm only nominated. I haven't been elected yet.
Oh, but you will be. You will be.
And so, on March 4th, 1913, he stood ready at last to help guide America to the new freedom of which he had talked all through the campaign. The new freedom which was to be nothing more nor less than the old and marvelous freedom which had always been America's. But revitalized now, Wilson made just one little joke before his inauguration.
It would be the irony of fate if my administration had to deal chiefly with foreign affairs.
Fate's ironies were minor at first. Revolution in Mexico caused anxiety, but did not distract him from his plans. Plans that astounded the practical man.
Reduce the tariff. Oh, sure, everybody's for it. I am for it, you're for it, he's for it, except where it affects me or you or him. Reduce the tariff. Just let Wilson try.
Wilson tried and succeeded.
Public control over privately owned banks. Oh, the bankers have a word for that. Socialism.
Nevertheless, the Federal Reserve System was adopted, bringing with it an order and stability soon taken for granted as necessary.
Federal Trade Commission? Isn't a man's own business his own private affair anymore? Rural credits? Oh, now, wait a minute. Louis Brandeis as a judge in the Supreme Court. Does Wilson think he can make that appointment stick? A Jew in the Supreme Court? Oh, never.
Patiently, stubbornly, irresistibly, Wilson fought through to victory on every point.
All through the centuries, there has been this slow, painful struggle forward. Up, up a little at a time. Along the entire interminable way. What difference does it make if we do not reach the uplands? We have given our lives to the enterprise, and that is richer, and the moral is greater.
But now it was August 1914, and the irony and tragedy of fate were both closing in on Wilson. August 1914, and his beloved wife lay dying. Even as over in Europe, an assassination in Sarajevo was setting off incredible catastrophe of European war. Overnight, America's enchanted remoteness was ended. Overnight now, the scholar in the White House had to learn the new and overwhelming lesson of Europe. There was no delay in the first conclusion.
America must be neutral in fact as well as in name. Impartial in thought, as well as in action.
Wilson's aide and confidant, Colonel House, brought back further conclusions from a tour overseas.
It is the general opinion now, Mr. President, that if the Allies win, it will mean the domination of the continent by Russia. If Germany wins, it means the tyranny of militarism for generations to come.
The despotism of the Romanovs, or the militarism of Germany. There is no victory, whichever side wins. So America must stay neutral, Ed, whatever the provocations. If we're drawn in, every domestic reform we've won with such effort will be lost.
Well, you're right, of course, Mr. President. Still, when you consider the ties of sympathy that binds us to England, all the...
No, we cannot consider them.
America must remain neutral, not just to save our own reforms. I have a hope that when the fighting ceases, America can take a vital role as peacemaker. But only if we stay neutral. We must stay neutral, whatever the cost.
1915. And now the country, agreeing with Wilson at first, was rapidly growing less neutral. Privately, as Wilson learned more of German war aims and post-war plans, his own neutrality was ebbing. But he still saw only one course for America, despite increased provocation. May 7th, 1915, in a German U-boat torpedoed and sank the liner Lusitania, 124 Americans, among the more than 1,000 who were lost. But Wilson still stood firm.
The example of America must be a special example. Not merely a peace because it will not fight, but a peace because peace is the healing and elevating influence of the world, and strife is not. There is such a thing as a man being too proud to fight. A nation being so right, it does not need to convince others by force.
May 16th, another election year. Wilson talked peace more vigorously than ever, but he hated the slogan, "He kept us out of war." Re-elected, he wondered desperately just how America could stay out. With his second wife, Edith, at his side now, he worked night after night on a speech to Congress, which would also be an appeal to the world, an appeal for something brand new in history.
Peace without victory? Oh, Woodrow, is there even a chance of it? A chance of both sides agreeing to stop now and arbitrate?
If the Germans have any idea of how bad things are with the Allies, no. But I'm banking on the fact that they don't know. That they're growing fearful of a stalemate. Though if they are, then perhaps there is a chance to work out the world's one hope for lasting peace. The League of Nations banded together in a community of power to outlaw war forever. It can be achieved, Edith, with America leading the way.
Scarcely a week later came the note from Berlin announcing a renewal of unrestricted submarine warfare. And by April 2nd, 1917, Woodrow Wilson no longer had a choice. He stood before the Congress asking for a declaration of war against Germany.
Well, about time. Everybody with any common sense knew it was coming. Now let's just hope Wilson will get off his soapbox until we've wiped up those Huns and cleaned things up over there.
But now, while men and material were gathered and sent in an ever-increasing tide overseas, and 1,000 details beset him daily, Wilson worked towards his main goal more passionately than ever. January 8, 1918, and his peace aims, outlined in 14 points, were released to the world. And all over Europe, the men of the Allied nations rejoiced.
Voyez donc, listen, Wilson has overlooked nothing. No more secret treaties, no more armaments, freedom of the seas, a trade, a League of Nations. Ah, it is like winning a battle to read such words. It is a victory in itself.
9 months later, Germany was appealing for peace to Wilson himself on the basis of the 14 points.
We can deal with no governments which do not represent the will of the governed.
The Kaiser abdicated. The new German Republic was ready now for the Allied surrender terms. And it was November 11th, 1918.
At last, I have you safely on shipboard, and for 9 whole days you're going to do nothing but rest, and sleep and rest some more.
Yes, my dear. And Fran, I wish you'd cope with the problems that lie ahead in Paris.
No, for just this little space of time, you must forget it all. You're so exhausted, you're ready to drop.
Ready to drop? When I'm sailing at last towards the hope of a dream come true. When I'm going at last to represent America at the council table, where all the free nations are going to work out a plan to outlaw war forever.
I know, but still a rest now.
We're going to be men full of passion in Paris, men full of bitterness. Somehow, in spite of this, Lloyd George and Clemenceau and Orlando and the rest of us must create a treaty of peace that will work. A treaty with a covenant for a League of Nations written into it, so tightly the two cannot be torn apart. It's the only way we'll have a means for gradually working out the problems we can't solve now. We have to achieve a league, Edith, or the war will have been in vain.
It was the dream embodied in the 14 points, the dream that so enkindled the minds and hearts of the common people of Europe, they cheered this light-tailed scholar like a conqueror. To them, indeed, he had come to magnify the peace of the world. But up at the level where peace had to be made, the voices rose angrily, demandingly.
If Europe is ever to be safe in the future, Germany must be crushed. Crushed to the ground.
Italy requires and demands Fiume. Italy agrees to no treaty that does not protect her against the Serbs and the Croats.
And all the while, the guns still fire in Russia, in Poland, in Finland, in Central Europe. But Wilson held fast. And Lloyd George and Clemenceau, honest men themselves, came to know a deep respect for this American who would bargain and compromise like a Yankee trader, but never give up on the main issue.
All right now, Woodrow. On this trip back, you are going to rest. 16 and 18 hours of work a day for the last 3 months. Well, it's enough to kill a strong man, which you are not.
Yes, I suppose I must rest a little. But the fight is only half won. Edith, I can't understand what's happening at home. Lodge and Knox and the others were never against the League before. What is this storm they are brewing?
It's just a political tempest, Woodrow.
The and the League can't turn into a party fight. I need the whole first draft before the Foreign Relations Committee as soon as we get back. I'll ask for every criticism, every suggestion that they'd like in a final draft when I go back to Paris. Now we have a start. We cannot lose, Edith. We dare not.
Back in Washington, the senators listened, questioned, objected. Only the senators Lodge and Knox, already committed to denouncing the treaty, kept ominously silent. And Wilson sailed back to Europe to hammer out through days and nights of effort every compromise the senators had asked for.
They see he's finally coming home in about time. The war's over. The president's place is here. As for that treaty he's so proud of, he could have saved himself the trouble. America can't commit herself to rushing in to settle all of Europe's quarrels. Oh, and this picture of him. He looks worn out, and what for? America is never going to buy that treaty or that League of Nations.
The practical man again. But wait, he's been wrong before. All through the long years of Wilson's public life, he was wrong every time. Perhaps there is a chance he can be wrong again.
Woodrow, you can't undertake a speaking tour like that. Dr. Grayson forbids it. It would kill you. A man in the prime of health couldn't stand it, and you're exhausted. You can't, Woodrow.
I have to, Edith. I have to talk to the people themselves. They've never failed yet, when the issues were clear to them. Once they understand what refusing to join the League would mean, once they understand that withholding cooperation now means war again, war worse than any horrors we've known, they won't fail, Edith. I know it.
By golly, it sounds like he's making a little progress. But they're cheering him wherever he goes. Indiana, St. Louis, out west. I have to hand it to him. He sure knows how to talk. But still, he's not going to make it.
Woodrow? Woodrow? My dear, what is it? Your ear, terribly ear. No, don't try to move. Dr. Grayson, come at once. The president has collapsed.
And now at last the practical man was right. In that time, in that America, Wilson failed, and Wilson died. And the calamity he predicted came to pass. Was all the effort in vain? Now, 100 years after the date of his birth, 10 years after the founding of the United Nations, his own words proclaim the faith that no such struggle is in vain.
All through the centuries, there has been this slow, painful struggle forward. What difference does it make if we do not reach the uplands? We have given our lives to the enterprise, and that is richer. And the morrow is greater thereby.
And even so, it is written in the Talmud,
It is not incumbent on you to finish this work, but neither are you free to desist from it. If you would like a copy of today's script, please send your name and address with 10 cents to cover the cost of postage to the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, 3080 Broadway, New York 27, New York. And now, we take great pleasure in presenting the Honorable Robert B. Minor, Governor of the State of New Jersey. Governor Minor.
You have just heard a dramatization of the public career of Woodrow Wilson as President of Princeton University, as Governor of the State of New Jersey, and as President of the United States. As one of Woodrow Wilson's successors in the office of Governor of New Jersey, I wish to congratulate the Eternal Light Radio Program and the Jewish Theological Seminary of America on this remarkable tribute to a great American whose 100th anniversary is being celebrated throughout the United States this year. It seems to me Marion Vogt, author of the script, Nor Reach the Uplands, has done a remarkable job in condensing the long career of Woodrow Wilson into dramatic form. Here are portrayed Wilson's battle for the democratization of a great university, his refusal as governor to send an unfit man to the Senate of the United States, his domestic reforms in the first presidential term, his battle with his conscience before the declaration of war on Germany in 1917, and his losing fight for American participation in the League of Nations. And now, as we look backward over the panorama of history, we find that Woodrow Wilson's idealism, his passionate hope for peace on earth among all peoples, has become a burning and practical necessity. It was not until another bloody war had been fought that the United Nations was born. Meantime, mankind reacts with horror at the creation of weapons deadly enough to destroy entire civilizations. We see now that Wilson was a major prophet of our century, and it behooves us, in the centennial year of 1956, to reflect long upon the eternal lessons he preached so patiently and so passionately. In doing so, we will not only be honoring a man's memory, we will be fashioning the means for our own self-preservation.
Thank you, Governor Minor. Our eternal light drama today, Nor Reach the Uplands, was written by Marion Vogt. Cantor Putterman sang the liturgical introduction. The music was composed by Morris Momorsky and conducted by Roy Shield. Featured in the cast were Santos Ortega, Robert Hastings, Rita Lloyd, Rosemary Murphy, Guy Sorrell, and Joe DeSantis. The narrator was Roger DeCoven. This is Mel Brandt. This has been an NBC Radio Network production, directed by Daniel Sutter. This weekly program is presented under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This is the NBC Radio Network.